Welcome to the Happy Menopause podcast. I'm Jackie Lynch, nutritional therapist and author of the books Vavavoom, the 10-Day Energy Diet and The Right Bite, Smart Food Choices for Eating on the Go. There are so many ways that diet and lifestyle can help to relieve a whole range of menopause symptoms. So join me on a journey through midlife and find out how you can have a healthy and happy menopause. Today's episode is all about weight management, because it's that time of year when you might be looking to lose a few pounds, and it's not an easy task for women in midlife. Honestly, as if the menopause wasn't tough enough with all the different symptoms you experience, the gradual increase in weight that comes with it can often feel like the last straw. This is the time in life when even women who've never had to watch their weight may start to notice that the pounds are creeping on. And most women find that it takes a lot more effort to shift a spare tyre than it used to. But help is at hand with today's guest. The brilliant Dr. Zoe Harkham joins me to talk through her tips for successful weight loss. But first, I'd like to give a quick shout out to our sponsors, Silk, who make it possible for me to produce this podcast. One of the midlife symptoms we don't often talk about is vaginal dryness. It can be a real problem during the perimenopause and the menopause, causing itching and discomfort, painful sex, and make it difficult to insert a tampon or to use a topical estrogen dispenser. So I'd like to say a big thank you to Silk, not just for supporting this podcast, but for offering a gentle and natural solution for women with vaginal dryness. Their plant-based formula is made in New Zealand with kiwi vine gum extract. It's a natural lubricant, which is water-based and pH-friendly, so that it gently soothes vaginal dryness and irritation, helping you rediscover your love life. It's available at all chemists and off the shelf in larger boot stores. Visit Silk, SYLK.co.uk to order your free sample. And so on to today's episode. I'm speaking to Dr. Zoe Harkham, a researcher, author, and specialist in weight management and obesity. It's an area she's always been passionate about, even when she was working full-time as a senior executive for a large blue-chip organisation, where she somehow found time to publish three books on the subject. In 2007, she left to become a full-time researcher, and this culminated in the publication of The Obesity Epidemic: What Caused It? How Can We Stop It? Zoe's also published numerous academic papers, and her Harkham Diet Club is an online community for people who are seeking support in developing a healthier lifestyle. Her advice is definitely worth listening to, so let's hear what she's got to say. Welcome to the Happy Menopause, Zoe.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm really looking forward to this.
Oh, well, listen, I'm delighted that you're here and can't wait to hear what you've got to say. So let's start out by you telling the listeners a little bit about your story, you know, how you got into the health world, what inspired you to become a researcher and a specialist, really, in the whole obesity and weight management area.
I guess it's just that I'm very mathematical and very logical, and the obesity epidemic is completely illogical. It just makes no sense. I have not met a single person who wants to be overweight, let alone obese, and yet we have nearly two-thirds, 70% in some countries, of our population meeting that definition. It just doesn't make sense, and it has never made sense to me. So as a hobby originally, when I was an HR director, it was the kind of thing that I did in the background. And then I got the opportunity to leave the corporate world and to pursue my passion, which was just trying to understand why so many people have a weight problem when, to me, it just doesn't make sense.
Right. And is weight management something that on a personal level has been relevant to you as well?
A long time ago, a very long time ago. And I guess that's also why it became an interest a while back, because I guess like every teenager, particularly female teenager, although males are catching up nowadays, but certainly in my era, it was very much women who had a bad relationship with food. And I did as a teenager, and I did throughout my years at Cambridge University. But I'd cracked it by my mid to late 20s. I'd worked out what I needed to do to make sure that I didn't crave things again. I had a relationship with food where I was in control. And that's just been fabulous, because that's been me ever since. And I have then tried to help other people who want to get to that happy place as well. And some people, many people I've helped to get there Some people still struggle. People have different levels of a poor relationship with food. And there, it's definitely the case that some people can overcome it more easily than others. But I do think that anyone can. I'm really, really optimistic that anyone can have a better relationship with food. And not everyone is going to be slim. Not everyone is going to be normal weight. If you've been obese for a number of years, for example, the longer you've been a particular weight and the larger you've been, the more difficult it is to get back into the normal range, particularly if it started younger in life. But I really do believe that people can be the best that they can be, and everyone can get on that journey.
Wow. Well, that's very reassuring to hear, because, and particularly because it's a journey that you yourself have been on, because I think that means you really do understand the challenges that people face when they are struggling to lose weight. And of course, weight management can be a real challenge for women during the menopause, because the pounds start to creep on, even for women who've never really had a weight management issue in the past, and it just won't shift. So what advice would you have for anyone whose usual tried and tested methods just aren't working now they're in midlife?
Well, you know, it's so interesting, because when people say that weight is all about calories in and calories out, and you just want to look at the hormonal situations in life. So when a girl turns into a woman, Gary Taubes talks about this, of course, she gains weight, and she doesn't just gain weight anywhere. She gains weight on her boobs and hips, if we're being very direct about it, and also thighs. She becomes a more womanly shape. And yes, he also then points out that the boys don't have that happen to them. So both girls and boys are gaining weight during puberty, but boys can develop into this sort of triangular action man, Daniel Craig kind of shape if they exercise and do fitness stuff and eat well. And girls will gain on the hips and the bust, particularly genetically. If their mum is more of a pear shape, they become more of a pear shape. If mum is more of an apple shape, they become more of an apple shape. So you've got the genetics and the hormones going on, but calories really hasn't got anything to do with it. And then, of course, you get to the menopause, and it's another hormonal time of life. And it's a time when women report, I'm not eating any differently to what I was eating, and I'm not doing any different level of activity to what I was doing just a year or two ago. But suddenly, as you say, there's a few pounds that seem to have come on, and I just can't shift. And it's like, well, hey, there you go. There's more evidence that weight is about hormones far more than it is about calories.
Right, right. And what do you think are the main challenges that midlife women face when it comes to trying to maintain a healthy weight?
I think one of them is probably just that you feel a bit blur anyway. More and more women are coming out and talking about this at the moment. So we've got people from Lorraine Kelly to Carol Vorderman. Is it Meg Matthews or something? One of the...
that's right.
Somebody else who's talked about it. So more and more people are talking about it and saying, actually, you just generally feel a bit rubbish, or you'll hear it on Women's Hour, and generally you just feel a bit rubbish and your sleep isn't good. And we do know that if people don't sleep well, then they're far more likely to make poor choices the next day, or feel that they need carbs or junk or something to pick them up. So there are sort of challenges of how people generally feel. I don't personally think that the menopause needs to, in and of itself, deliver more than a few pounds. It's not one of those, it's not quite like puberty. It's not when you will grow up and you will grow out. So again, I hope this is reassuring, not critical. But if you look at the evidence for, and weight gain has been observed in the menopause, so there is evidence for this, it tends to typically just be a few pounds. So I think if people are finding that it's been more than that, I really would have a really good look at what you are doing. I always recommend keeping a food diary. I just think they're so powerful when people think, oh, I'm really not doing anything differently to what I was doing a year ago. And then suddenly realize maybe they've introduced something back into their diet, or they've given up a hobby that they used to really enjoy, or something might have changed that is accounting for more than those few pounds. Because I think it can play havoc with about up to half a stone, but I don't think people should be worrying about 20 pounds during the menopause kind of life. I think it's a smaller amount, and I think it can be manageable.
I think that's really interesting advice there. One of the things, of course, I observe in my nutrition clinic a lot of the time is that vicious cycle that comes with the menopause. You've touched on some of the issues, the symptoms that can happen, the fatigue that can come during the perimenopause years, so that you might feel that you're less inclined to exercise. And then, of course, that can have an impact on you, or that you're feeling anxious and low and might be turning to food as a source of comfort and perhaps tucking into chocolate in a way that a few years earlier you didn't really feel the need for. So I think that without realizing, sometimes new habits can start to come in as part of that overall process, in as a woman's instinctive response to what's going on. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
Oh, absolutely. And this relationship with food, that in some way we see that food cheers us up. I quite often talk about this on radio interviews. It starts so young. And I've been accused on the radio of being, oh, you're a real killjoy, you're a real meanie or whatever, because I'm saying stop giving kids all these sweets all the time. Or at the very least, if you're going to give them a sweet, can you call it junk? Call it what it is. Stop calling it a treat and stop this association between I fall over and I get a sweet and then I feel good, or I go to school and it's my birthday, this cake, and I feel good. And Halloween, I get sweets, I feel good. Christmas, I get sweets, I feel good. I mean, it's just endless. It's just endless. It's almost every week there's a birthday, or there's an occasion, or there's Easter, or there's something else going on, or the school fete, or something or other. And you then try to work with women from their teens onward, 20s onwards, and you're already battling 20 years, 30 years, sometimes 40 or 50 years of an association having been built up between I eat junk and then I feel good. And we call it cheats in our club. So I want people to say, okay, if you do have ice cream or confectionery or biscuits or cakes or whatever, make sure it's a conscious choice, but make sure at the same time you're calling it what it is, which is a cheat or junk or rubbish or CRAP, whatever you want to call it, but make sure you build up a new association and then start revisiting how ingrained it is that you think this stuff is going to make you feel good, because it's really not going to make you feel good. It's going to make you feel good for about a few seconds, maybe a few minutes, when the sugar high hits and we do physiologically get that incredible sugar high. And then very, very soon afterwards, we get the sugar low and the blood glucose goes lower than it was before we ate the junk. And then we feel miserable and we can feel quite depressed and quite low and quite blue and quite weepy. It's like, well, how did that cheer us up? Know what happens in the cycle, know where the cycle ends up. And then the next day, perhaps you've had a binge and you feel hungover. You've got the puffy carb face. Remember all of that. Don't just remember the first couple of seconds when the chocolate goes in the mouth and you think, oh, that's great, my boss has been mean, but I've now got chocolate and I feel really good. I mean, work it through, because over the next 24 hours, overall, you are not going to feel good. So just don't do it. You've got to break that cycle.
Well, that's really good advice. I mean, one of the things I talk about with my clients is about reframing treats and starting to think about perhaps treating yourself to a massage or a facial or something that isn't going to be a food-based treat, but that still helps to trigger the reward receptors in the brain so that they're feeling great. But I think it's really interesting.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, you touch on blood sugar there. And for me, that very much is the absolute core of managing your health during menopause. Because, of course, as your blood sugar drops, the stress hormones come out, and they can very much start to cause absolute havoc with what's going on. Because if you're overstressed and there's too many stress hormones, then your adrenal glands that are programmed to produce the estrogen that you need post-menopause just are too busy to do that. So that ultimately you'll end up with a hormone imbalance. And of course, one of the places that the body can store estrogen is in fat cells. So, of course, it will encourage the body to store fat as a kind of plan C, which is the very thing that many women don't want to be happening.
Do you know, I think the best overall way to lose weight is to manage your blood glucose level.
Yeah.
And when you tell people that there are 4 grams of glucose in your bloodstream at any one time, that blows most people away, because you can get a teaspoon out of the cupboard and put a teaspoon of sugar together and show people and say, in your entire bloodstream at any one time, that's the amount that you've got of glucose. Obviously, sucrose is fructose and glucose. That's the glucose in your bloodstream. So have a medium apple and you've probably put in twice as much glucose into your bloodstream as your body could cope with. And your body then has to get the glucose out of the bloodstream because that it's perceived as a dangerous situation. So the body will encourage insulin to be released. Insulin goes in, attaches to the glucose, turns it into glycogen, which is the stored form of glucose, and takes it out of the bloodstream. So we no longer have that dangerous 999 situation. But the body doesn't always get it right. And particularly with modern food, when we're eating stuff that we have just not evolved to eat. You know, the sweetest thing we may ever have got hold of was berries in season. And then suddenly we're giving people Häagen-Dazs ice cream with marshmallow cookie dough in the middle of it. I mean, what hope has the body got?
Well, that's so true.
To try to take the glucose out of the bloodstream.
Absolutely. And that combination of fat and sugar that you get in ice cream is a combination that doesn't exist in nature. So incredibly addictive. You know, we very smart evolved humans have created this.
That is exactly what I say in presentation. So I have a little diagram showing people that basically nature provides fat proteins or carb proteins. Very, very rarely does nature put fat, carb and protein all in the same foods in good measure. And the exceptions are nuts and seeds. And nuts particularly, I find just completely Moorish. To me, they are like cookie dough or ice cream or crisps. If somebody puts a bowl of cashews in front of me and I start eating them, I could eat the whole lot easily. It's easier for me just not to have that first one. That's nature's unique little carb-fat combo. But in the fake food world, there's no such uniqueness. They have recognized that combo is rare. It's unnatural. We've not evolved to handle it. And they make every fake food based with its crisps, cookies, pizza, chips, burgers, milkshakes. They are all based on that carb-fat combo. And the body has no chance to get the blood glucose level precisely back into that normal range. So let's say then it gets it too low. And then we're in the state that we call hypoglycemia, low blood glucose. And the second you're in a low blood glucose state, that's when you are most susceptible to your body telling you to eat, because that's what your body is designed to do. Your body is designed to say, right, glucose is low now, go and get some food. And that, I think, is the single thing that will defeat most dieters. So if you can keep your blood glucose stable, you have got a much better chance of fighting the diet war.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And of course, you know, January is very much that time of year after all the Christmas festivities where a lot of the fad diets will come out of the woodwork. For me, the menopause is really not the time to be looking at strict fasting regimes or weird exclusion diets or very stringent calorie counting. Where do you sit on all of that?
I don't think any time of life is good for those, to be honest. I really don't. I've come to the conclusion that the way to lose weight, and I'm not much into personalized nutrition either, because I do think this is pretty universal. So my principles that I share with people are basically, number one, eat real food. We shouldn't need to call it real food. They should need to call theirs fake junk food. And people say, oh, what's that? Well, oranges grow on trees. Cartons of orange juice don't. Fish swim in the sea. Fish fingers don't. It's not that difficult. Don't make it complex. It's food that comes from farms, not factories. Number two, choose that real food for the nutrients it provides. Now, that was the rule that I set that then ended my 20 years of being vegetarian. Because when you look at food and where nutrients are found, much as I hated to discover this, the most nutrient-dense foods are animal foods. And the most nutrient-dense of all is offal. I know I don't like it either, particularly liver. Then red meat is better than white meat. Oily fish is better than white fish. Egg yolks, obviously, much better than egg whites. Dairy is good, provided you're not intolerant. And the intolerance tends to be much more ethnically organized than people realize. So it's meat, fish, eggs, dairy, vegetables, salads. Avoid the nuts and seeds if you're trying to lose weight. Fruit in season. Most people are okay with some grains. I don't think many people are okay with wheat, but some brown rice, baked potato here and there. But if you've got the baked potato or the brown rice on your plate and you've got red meat and vegetables, then the baked potato and brown rice are really not bringing that much to the party. The starchy foods are really not all that And then the third rule is eat a maximum of 3 times a day, because we just eat the whole time at the moment in the developed world, and it has got to stop. It's a recipe for getting type 2 diabetes as well as obesity.
Yeah, I think that's very true. We do eat way more than we need to. We have a much more sedentary life than even sort of 20 or 30 years ago. Everything is designed for us to be carried. We're carried by cars. We're carried by moving staircases. We don't move freely and naturally. And I often say again to clients is there's absolutely no point in doing or in assuming that your 3 times a week trip to the gym is going to help you lose weight if you just don't move the rest of the time, because we're just not naturally active anymore in the way that we've been, well, we were designed to be, that we're programmed to be.
Yeah. I mean, I actually think weight loss is so much more about what you put in your mouth rather than what you do with your body. I mean, I don't know if it's 90-10 or 95-5, but I say to people that I work with, it's about what you put in your mouth. If you think you can burn off putting bad stuff in your mouth, you're always going to lose this battle, because you just simply cannot burn off. It's quite interesting. It's in the news today, I think, isn't it? They're saying, can we put on packages how long you'd have to run to burn off this particular thing?
Oh, I saw that. Yes.
and you just can't burn off the amount of junk that it's possible to eat. So I'm totally with you that being non-sedentary is far more important than exercising. If you've got a, it sounds sort of like they're the same thing, but they're not. Exercising is doing something quite active, going to the gym or going for a swim or going for a walk. Being non-sedentary is far more important, which is don't sit down for a long period of time. Move, even when you're watching television, get up during the ad breaks. Just don't sit there the whole time, because that's what's going to send us to an early grave.
But absolutely.
Do movement because it's a healthy thing to do, not because you think it's going to help you to lose weight, because it isn't.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing that I would really sort of support in terms of the regular exercise, of course, is the impact it has on stress and the roundabout way that high levels of stress can impact your weight. But I mean, it really is food first. That's what you've got to focus on getting right. The other thing I wanted to touch on with you, actually, Zoe, is the whole fat, low fat issue, because many women still assume that, you know, poor old fat, it needs a new PR company, really, because there's an obvious logic to assuming that eating too much fat will make you fat, when in fact dietary fat has really nothing to do with that whole biochemical process in the body. But of course, many people make that assumption. And of all the times in life to be going on a very low fat diet, for me, a midlife, menopausal women should just not be doing that. What's your view on that?
Yeah, no, totally agree. I mean, it's where so many of the nutrients are found. So if you're looking particularly at the fat soluble vitamins, they're called fat soluble vitamins because they tend to come in foods that contain fat, because we need fat to absorb the vitamin at the same time. So nature very sensibly will put the vitamins in full fat dairy products more richly than in low fat dairy, and will put those nutrients in oily fish more densely than in white fish, red meat more densely than white meat, and so on. And people who take the skin off the chicken, that was the most nutrient dense bit. I'm not necessarily advocating eating fat on steak unless you've cooked it very nicely and it's particularly nice. Some of it can get a bit gristly, but we are designed to eat dietary fat. And given that there are only 3 things that we eat, and protein tends to be a fairly constant 15, maybe 20% of any natural diet, particularly to lose weight, I'm one of the people that think we should be watching carbohydrates far more acutely than we should be watching fat. And of course, if you visualize now a pie chart where about 15 to 20% of that pie chart is protein, you've got the rest that needs to be made up from fat and carbohydrate. And at the moment, our dear government is saying have 55% in the form of carbohydrate and just 30% in the form of fat. And because I think we should be cutting back way down from that level of carbohydrate, let's say you did go on quite a low carbohydrate diet, maybe 5 or 10% of calorie intake, you can see what has to happen to the other portion of the pie, excuse the pun. It has to take up the slack. So carbohydrate, on a low carbohydrate diet, fat will inevitably end up being about 70 or 80% of the diet. And of course, women who've been on a low fat diet all of their life, they panic thinking, oh my goodness, how am I going to cope with all of that fat? But it's not that you're adding fat. In fact, I'm really anti this bulletproof coffee stuff, chucking fat in, adding butter on top of steak and all the rest of it. If you've got body fat to lose, you should not be doing that. But if you just go low carb, then your macronutrients will be what they will be. And that means that fat will be a bigger proportion of your diet. But don't panic, because it's also bringing lots of nutrients at the same time.
Yes, and of course it does such an important job in the body. You know, we need fat to make our sex hormones, for example. As you rightly said, we need it to absorb our fat-soluble vitamins. So that's vitamin D, for example. And we all know how important vitamin D is for not just our immune health and our mental health, but the bone health as well, which is incredibly important for any woman in midlife.
No, absolutely.
Brain health. Our brain is made of fat. Skin health, you know, if you want that dewy, glowy skin as you move into midlife, again, having a diet that is rich in fat is important. No,
and of course, it's the repair and building block in the body. There's a really interesting table, actually, if you look at what macronutrients do. And fat is actually the most usable macronutrient, because if you break it down into quite simple terms, we've either got macronutrients that are good for providing energy, and carbohydrate, that's all carbohydrate does. Fat can also provide energy. And then you've got the other requirements of the body, which is building bone density, fighting infection, general cell repair, et cetera, which of course protein is good for, but fat can also do that. So fat is most likely to be used up. I don't worry about the fat that I eat.
No, and it's an incredibly rich source of energy as well for the body. So there's just lots to love about it. And it's certainly not something I'd recommend in terms of weight management at, you know, this phase of life.
No, absolutely.
Now, I know that you're madly busy, Zoe, going out there, spreading the message, supporting all these people. Do you manage to practice what you preach? And how do you manage it if you do?
I do, because I have to, because I couldn't do what I do if I didn't. So I do eat real food. I do. I'm in phase three of what we call our diet that I sort of developed in my 20s and have stuck to ever since. So phase three is what you can get away with. And that means I eat dark chocolate every day. If I'm at a ski resort and they have the most fabulous croissants, I'm going to have a croissant. But I do not have croissants every day. I don't have starchy carbohydrates every day. I happened to have them last night at a dinner party. Brown rice, it was absolutely delicious. I can't remember the last time I ate bread. I can't remember the last time I ate a biscuit. I can't remember the last time I ate cake. If you don't eat them, you don't miss them. Really, 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 you don't. Just believe me. So my diet is pretty much based on what I recommend. Meat, particularly red, fish, particularly oily. I love dairy, full fat dairy, yogurt, milk every day, quite a lot. Fruit, I do have some. I know it's not the health food it's cracked out to be, but I enjoy it, so I have it. As I say, the dark chocolate, chocolates sometimes if I want them, but never to the point that I would start craving them again. And I just find that's a great way to live, to be honest. I really don't need the junk in my life. It's not going to make me feel good. I enjoy being slim, and I enjoy being slim really easily. That's going to sound awful if people have got a weight problem, but I went through a lot of work to get there. I went through the food addiction and overcoming the food addiction. So I kind of feel I've earned where I've got to. I've put in the willpower when it counted, and now I don't need to, because I'm there. I'm doing what I should be doing. I move every day. I go for a walk. We had a dog until about this time last year, and bless her. She then moved on. But we still try to walk. We walk other dogs in the village. We move. I do gardening. I do cleaning. Cleaning the windows is one of the best arm workouts you'll ever get. Cleaning the floor, great for the stomach. I don't smoke. I happen not to drink just because I don't like the taste. But I think moderate drinking is actually healthier than not drinking. What are the other good things we should do? Smoke, move, eat, drink. There's a fifth one, isn't there? Alcohol, exercise, food. Oh, being the right weight. When you look at the Kafili study, those are the five healthy things that would increase life expectancy and avoid, hopefully, chronic illness in later life. So staying close as one can to a healthy weight as well is a good thing to do. Get good sleep as well, actually. I'm a really good sleeper. I could sleep for Wales. That would be my Commonwealth sport.
Oh, wow. That makes a difference to everything. If you've had a good night's sleep, everything is so much easier. I think the overall message I'm hearing very much is that if you practice moderation, then moderation becomes easier because you don't have those cravings because you're not stimulating your body with the things that generate the craving.
Yeah, I'd probably say it's actually avoidance rather than moderation. I don't think you can be an addict in moderation. At the time, I knew that I was a sugar addict and I could plow my way through chocolates, biscuits, way more than was healthy for any individual. You can't then wake up the next morning and say, right, I'm just going to have one biscuit today, or I'm just going to have a couple of Quality Street, knowing that the minute you've opened the box, you're going to have the whole lot. So I actually think you need to practice avoidance for quite a long period of time. And only if you can then handle something like that coming back into your life should you go ahead and do it, because it just really is so much easier to avoid it than to try to have something in moderation. It just is. That's why Alcoholics Anonymous says just put all your effort into not having that next drink. Now, obviously, food addiction is a bit different because we can't stop drinking. We have to eat, but we can stop eating junk. And that's the difference. You know, the alcoholic is still drinking coffee and water. They're just not drinking alcohol. We can still eat real food and good food. We just have to stop eating biscuits, cakes and cookies and ice cream. And the stuff, basically, if you knock sugar and white flour out of your diet, you're pretty much there. Now, for me, the sugar has come back into my diet in very dark chocolate, 85% dark chocolate. So that means 10-12% of the rest of that bar is sucrose. So I am having some sucrose in my diet. Mm. But it doesn't taste sweet and it doesn't stimulate cravings for other sweet things. So I know I'm okay with it. So that's what I can handle. Some people can't handle even dark chocolate, so they choose not to have it. Some people can handle, going back to starchy carbohydrates for their main meal every night. And that's fine for them. I think that bit is individual, but I think the three basic rules of how to eat well and be the weight you want to be, I think they're universal.
Okay, really interesting. Now, if the listeners want to find you, to find out more about what you do and to get more information from you, where can they do that?
Yeah, mostly I've got a website, which is just Zoe Harcombe, HARCOMBE.com. And on Twitter, I'm just Zoe Harcombe as well. So those are the two places where I tend to hang out.
I'll be sure to put links to your website and your Twitter handle on the show notes on the podcast page of my website, so anyone can refer to that and know how to find you from there. But before we wrap up, if you could only give sort of two top tips to the listeners for successful weight management, what would they be?
It would be, I'd need three, because I need those three tips. Eat real food, choose the real food for the nutrients it provides, and eat maximum three times a day. And I think you need all three, because you could have number one, and if you don't have number two, you could end up a vegan. So you can eat real food as a vegan, but if you don't choose the real food for the right nutrients, you could end up on a plant-based diet. And I don't think that's going to be helpful, particularly at the menopause. Well, at any stage of life, actually, it's not going to be helpful. And if you do the first two, but you don't eat a maximum of three times a day, you're just picking at dairy and having cappuccinos every hour, you never allow your body to get into a weight loss situation, a weight loss physiological state. So we have to have periods of time. I'm not a fan of fasting, certainly not days at a time. I think that would be miserable, utterly miserable. Overnight fasting, yes. So when you've had your dinner, clean your teeth. If you can have your dinner early, 6 o'clock, maybe finished, breakfast late, 7 o'clock, you've got a 13-hour overnight fast there without too much effort. And the other good thing about stopping as soon as you've had your dinner, clean your teeth, is that the time we're most likely to eat junk is the evening. So you stop that bad eating stage as well.
That's a great tip, actually. Clean your teeth straight after dinner. Excellent. Okay. Well, listen, it's been absolutely great talking to you. So much information. I think people are going to have to listen to this several times to get all those brilliant nuggets. But thanks so much for joining us. Really enjoyed speaking to you today.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me. It was so lovely meeting you at the ION conference in September. So that was a real pleasure. Thanks so much for the approach.
So that's it for today's episode. There's a lot to unpick there and some really great advice. But remember, whatever you do, clean your teeth after dinner. If you'd like to find out more about Zoe's work, head on over to the show notes on my website, well-well-well.co.uk. Where you can find details of her website, the the Harkham Diet Club, and her social media. Next month, we're talking about sex, baby. My guest is the fabulous Tracy Cox, sex and relationship expert, and we'll be discussing how you can get your va-va-voom back if you've been struggling with low libido. If you've enjoyed this episode, please do leave a star rating and a review on Apple iTunes or whichever platform you listen on. And make sure you tell all your friends. It makes a huge difference to the visibility of the podcast and really helps to spread the word. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.